they decided to take a risk in the near term and cut procurement of existing programs that are in full rate production in order to preserve dollars for research and development of what Secretary Kendall has called the future force.
From the Defense and Aerospace Report, this is the Air Power Podcast, powered by GE Aerospace. I'm J.J. Gertler.
And I'm Vago Maradian. Over the past few programs on this network, we've discussed the Biden administration's fiscal 2025 budget request for defense. Our team of reporters, the Sunday Business Roundtable, and Byron Callen have all weighed in. Now we hear from one of the most insightful budget teams in town, the crew from the Center for a New American Security. And we have our headlines in Air Power.
And GE brings the power to Air Power. The GE Aerospace XA-100 engine is tested and ready to deliver 30% more range, 20% greater acceleration, and twice the cooling to help the U.S. maintain its air power advantage. Learn more at geaerospace.com/XA-100.
And the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is also brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. JJ, what's in the news this week on All Wings Considered?
Brother, can you spare a lightning? Denmark is considering borrowing or, if necessary, buying F-35s from other countries. Their own jets are held up in Lockheed's delivery hiatus, waiting for the certification of the TR-3 upgrade. But Denmark is so eager to get jets, they're willing to take ones without TR-3. Japan is looking to export the fighter it's co-developing with Britain and others under the Global Combat Aircraft Program. We rather suspected that they and the participants in the German-French FCAS program would be oriented to exports, while the U.S. Next Generation Air Dominance platform likely is not going to be exported. Will the U.S. shut itself out of the world market for sixth-generation aircraft? Stay tuned. Switzerland is planning to retire its remaining F-5 fleet. You may recall a few years ago, the United States Marine Corps bought 22 F-5s from Switzerland to use as adversary training aircraft. Will this new batch of Tiger IIs wind up in U.S. dress, or perhaps with a private adversary air company? And finally, Vago, you have notes on the passing of an airman's airman.
I do indeed, JJ. This week, Lieutenant General Tom Stafford, one of America's greatest astronauts and heroes, passed away at age 93. He was a veteran of two Gemini and two Apollo missions, one that tested the lunar module near the lunar surface to make the Apollo 11 moon landing possible, and the other, the Apollo Soyuz test project, the mission to demonstrate Soviet-American cooperation in space in 1975 at the height of the Cold War. He was also one of my heroes growing up, and it was an honor to get to know him professionally, and I just have to say he simply was one of the most impressive human beings I've ever met. It's sad that these giants are passing. The great Frank Borman died in November, and he was another hero. I urge the audience to take a minute to remember them, their accomplishments that should really serve as a shining inspiration and testament to the extraordinary things our nation can accomplish. Little Tom Stafford trivia, he and the Apollo 10 crew remain the fastest that humans have ever traveled on their return from the moon. We offer our condolences to the Stafford family and our sympathies to all those who knew him.
A notable fellow, the first astronaut to become a general officer, and a distinguished graduate of the United States Naval Academy, who made his mark in the Air Force.
Indeed, and he noted that, but I think many people also don't know that he served in the Oklahoma National Guard, I believe in an artillery unit, if my memory serves correctly, and became an astronaut in 1962. But he was in the second group after the original Mercury astronauts. I think he just missed it by a little bit, if I recall the story correctly, and just was, you know, a towering figure, you know, a tremendously impressive human being. You know, I remember interviewing him on video for the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 10 mission. And during the interview, I, you know, mentioned the fact that it was the 50th anniversary. And he said, yes. And exactly now, 50 years ago, we had fired our engines to return to Earth. So somebody who knew the exact timing of burns. When you would talk to them, he had incredibly specific recall. He was also Air Force Acquisition Executive, which many people have a tendency of forgetting. So knew the engineering, knew the business side, being a Harvard Business School graduate. And I then gave him a ride once. And when he got in the car, he was preparing for, you know, a Space Council meeting or a Space Committee meeting or something. You know, so he gave me right, two blocks, left, left, four blocks, make a right, drop us off at the back end, and then turn to the people in the back seat that I was giving a ride to get ready for the committee hearing that they were going to go into, right? And here he was 90, 89, 88 years old, and he was still completely with it. So, I mean, a very, very impressive human being. Just two contributions, right? I mean, the Japanese are doing GCAP, I think, in part because the United States would not export, right? The F-22 was never designed for export, and it became an issue, and we did not want to export it. They didn't necessarily, I think, want to pay the charges to make it an exportable aircraft. So we had denied them, and that burned the Japanese pretty badly. And it looked like they were going to go with the Eurofighter instead of eventually going for the F-35. And now they want to develop their own airplane. And speaking of the Danes, right, they're sending their F-16s to the Ukrainians, right? So that also gives them another problem. They're waiting for their new jets as they get rid of their older airplanes.
And a reminder, don't miss our other weekly podcasts, Cavis Ships, hosted by Chris Cavis and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace. They clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink, brought to you by TE Connectivity, where Laura Winter takes a thoughtful look at all things space. And our Cyber Report, hosted by Vago Maradian.
And joining us now is the budget team from the Center for a New American Security, Dr. Stacey Pettyjohn and her colleague Hannah Dennis. Welcome to the Air Power Podcast.
Thanks for having us. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
We're really looking forward to having you on to help us take a little bit of a deeper dive in the budget. Stacey, I want to start off with you. There were some folks who, you know, have a very negative reaction to the budget. The administration should have asked for more money. This isn't enough money. They made all the wrong choices that sent all the wrong signals to our adversaries as well as our allies. And there are others who say, look, there was a budget deal that was struck. There's a cap. They're building a budget to that cap. They're not unrealistically going to ask for more money that they're not necessarily going to get. And oh, by the way, there is $100 billion supplemental, a lot of which is munitions funding, which we'd love to get Hannah's take on because she's been diving deeply into that issue. From a top line standpoint, Air Force Acquisition Chief Andrew Hunter, our mutual friend, has said, look, I mean, some of these decisions that we took, we didn't want to take. We took them because we didn't have the money and we had to make some hard choices. And at the end of the day, it was about hard choices. What was your take overall, Stacey, on the budget? What did you like about it? What did you didn't? Because they were trying to do the best they could with the money they had, which meant, you know, you don't get the magic flying pony that you wanted.
I agree with you. I think they were trying to do the best, and they did realize that the budget caps were something that they couldn't avoid. And 1 year of a slightly reduced budget from where they would ideally be is not necessarily something that would set them back too much. I think I've heard from other folks in the administration, the bigger impediment to actually being able to implement their strategy and follow through are the CRs, are the inability of Congress to actually pass the budget, whether it's a supplemental or the main appropriations bill. Secretary Kendall reiterated that it was money and Congress actually following through and passing appropriations on time. And that could really come to a head this year. There could be cascading effects since we're about 6 months in and still on a continuing resolution. If that doesn't get passed, this whole FY25 budget request is sort of null and void because it's predicated on the FY24 request getting funded. And that is looking, I mean, I keep hearing promising signs that they're close on the Hill, but we still aren't there. And there's certainly a bigger sort of gap in terms of the supplemental. For the Air Force specifically, I think that they tried to avoid some of the mistakes that had happened with the Budget Control Act previously and to deliberately take risk in certain areas instead of peanut butter spreading the cuts across the entire force. And in this respect, they're a bit of an outlier compared to the other services. I heard Deputy Secretary Hicks saying yesterday that the department as a whole prioritized readiness and cut research and development in favor of procurement. But the Air Force, if you look at their numbers, they actually did the opposite. They preserved readiness. They realized how deep of a hole they got in with the Budget Control Act and how hard it was to regain those skills that they needed as a result of the cuts to readiness at that time. But they decided to take a risk in the near term and cut procurement of existing programs that are in full rate production in order to preserve dollars for research and development of what Secretary Kendall has called the future force.
Well, let's follow up on that just a bit, because this budget funds research on a number of next generation systems in every service and every domain. Over the last few years, R&D has really been emphasized, sometimes to the detriment of procurement. At what point do you have to stop developing the next generation and actually start buying it?
I think that's a really good question, JJ. And the challenge is that the department has to do that both at the same time, right? They need to make sure that their research and development programs, the priority ones, make it across that valley of death and enter into procurement so that the technologies are mature enough. But they also need to make sure that you maintain enough capacity and the right types of capabilities in the near term. And I do think across the Department of Defense as a whole, different services are in different phases of their modernization. The Army has hit the point where it is moving into procurement of a lot of the acquisition priorities that they've had for a long time. And with declining budgets in real terms, they're sort of forced to make some hard choices with respect to, you know, future vertical lift so that they can fund their other priorities. The Air Force is really sort of betting on and focused on the next generation of capabilities that are embodied in NGAD and the related systems, and willing to accept a little bit of risk in the current capabilities in terms of F-35 and F-15EX production this year. They may also be playing a bit of a game because they expect that Congress, if they're going to add anything back, it would be those current systems that are in production. So they're betting that they're going to protect their investments in the future research on the assumption that Congress will buy back for them the current capabilities that they also want.
I want to sort of build a little bit, Stacey, on what you were saying in terms of priorities. A lot of this are going to be shaped by the reorganization of the Air Force that Secretary Kendall and the Chief of Staff General Alvin have launched. And both of them have said, look, we're not optimized for great power competition. There's a whole series of changes we have to make. We have to consolidate the requirement setting so that it's not just done at a major command level, but are more cross-cutting across the Air Force, sort of the reconstitution, but an improved version of the Air Force Systems Command that was eliminated at the end of the Cold War. Disaggregating, for example, the operating wings at bases from the guys who are running the bases, right, in order to be able to do more agile combat operations and still to have somebody who fights the base. But you guys have been doing a lot of wargaming, actually, to build some thoughtful roadmaps into what those future capabilities look like. Sort of against that backdrop, how do you assess the changes the Air Force is making, and is it going to deliver the expected results? And then, Hanno, you know, what are the budgetary implications? Because, again, the Secretary and the Chief have both said, this may demonstrate that the force we have is simply not big enough, especially to conduct a high op tempo, as well as do those large scale exercises for the future. How do you suss this into what the budget impact is going to be?
They're trying to keep the cost down as much as possible. But as you find with reorganizations, they tend to cost money, whether you want them to or not. I think there's a lot of good in the effort and the reoptimization of the force. There's so many pieces in there that, what was it, they announced 20-some initiatives. So there's a lot to unpack. But when you look at conducting distributed operations or agile combat employment, they're changing their force presentation and sort of force generation models in a way that I think should help them to support these operations and also protect readiness of units so that the units that deploy are going to have trained together. They're going to deploy as units that know each other. They're smaller, but they're going to make up for their small size because they're going to be very cohesive and agile, to use the buzzword again. The other piece of it, though, that they stated was that they're hoping that this will help to improve overall readiness and make it clear to senior leaders the impact of the decision to deploy different forces on long-term readiness and the availability of different units for various operations. And I think while the reorganization is likely to help support and allow the Air Force to conduct ACE operations, it's going to have a hard time limiting deployments since that's inevitably a political decision. And we've seen that presidents and cabinet level officials remain wedded to the notion of deploying forces overseas in response to crises, whether they're really strengthening deterrence or enabling responsiveness in a way that's needed. On the Integrated Capabilities Office and sort of moving the acquisition framework, and this is something where I think Hannah can weigh in on how the Space Force does things, this sort of discussion has predated Secretary Kendall and the current leaders of the Air Force. They were talking about this when the Space Force was actually stood up, and there were rumblings that this type of reorganization was needed to help make sure that the service was considering its requirements holistically and not, you know, stovepipe in the different MAGCOMs. Especially this was more important as they're trying to, you know, conduct JADC2, and that this can help them to better identify requirements and, you know, move towards a more agile acquisition process, which are both things that I know the Space Force has been trying to do and that Hannah can speak a little bit to.
Sure. So the Space Force, I think, has made a lot of really good progress in the last year and how it's kind of reorganized to take a specific mission sets more from cradle to grave. So in some ways, I think they may be paving a path that the other services could look at, but those initiatives are still very early. So there's a lot of proving left to be done, I think. I wanted to talk a little about Vago. You mentioned sort of the lessons from a lot of the war games that we've run and then how that is affecting sort of how the Air Force will prepare for the future. The research that I have worked on with Stacey a lot has been looking specifically at munitions, and a lot of the games that we have run have really focused on the likelihood of protraction and the follow-on needs for having kind of a mix of capabilities, the higher end stuff, but also being able to generate the mass that would be needed and having a defense industrial base that can sustain a level of production through a protracted conflict. And the Air Force is clearly taking a lot of those lessons really seriously from Ukraine and also looking forward to the Indo-Pacific. So I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that on the munitions side.
Well, let's follow on that industrial base issue for a bit. In hardware programs, this looks pretty much like a mixed bag. Aircraft procurement, this is an Air Power podcast. We kind of focus on the things with wings and rotors. It's down 55 planes and helicopters from what was projected last year to be acquired this year. Spending on next generation air dominance is up. Procurement money for B-21 significantly down. The Navy is delaying developing its next generation fighter. Is there any particular theme to the hardware lines in this budget? And specifically with reference to munitions, we're sending munitions all over the world. How well are we doing at refilling our own coffers?
In terms of hardware, I do think there is a bit of hedging going on as the services are waiting to see what becomes technologically feasible and then politically acceptable by policy and regulation in terms of uncrewed and autonomous systems. Seeing a pretty big sea change in Ukraine that I have argued is an evolution, not a revolution, but uncrewed systems are playing a huge role in a way never before. And I think that is giving some pause in terms of how much is needed for the mix of crewed versus uncrewed aircraft going forward and what type. And to me, it seems like there aren't particularly well-formulated ideas. You know, Replicator plays into this. And from what I can tell, the Air Force isn't really playing a big role this year at all, or in the FY25 request. And the types of systems that the Air Force would need on the higher end are very different than those that the Army or the Marine Corps would need for obvious reasons. So I do think you're seeing a bit of hedging on current technologies, but it's also sort of a mixed message. I mean, you have the Air Force moving into developing and then procuring the E-7 as well, which is, you know, a great airborne battle management aircraft, but it is vulnerable in the same way as that AWACS and others are that the Air Force is saying it wants to get away from. So you've heard the Air Force thinking about uncrewed systems. The other piece of this to keep in the back of your mind is what they're relying on space for and whether they think space is going to be increasingly providing certain capabilities and fulfilling certain missions like ISR and finding mobile targets, things like that. Hannah, what do you think on the munition side?
JJ, to your point, replenishment of the stuff that we've given Ukraine is really important on the Air Force side, specifically looking at AMRAAM and APKWS, which we gave. But I think that there's a sense in this budget that there's sort of a shift away from some shorter range systems to actually focus on the longer range systems, which is something we called for and has been pretty long overdue. And is kind of one of the reasons that they were able to keep the munitions procurement budget relatively stable from last year's request to this year's request. Just looking specifically at LRASM, the number that is requested this year is almost double what was projected for this year. And that's sort of balanced out by SDB1 and SDB2 quantities are a little down. The AIM-9 is a little bit down. JDAM is way down from the quantities that we requested last year, but that was projected. The quantities for those go down a lot, for LRASM to go up a little because those systems are much more expensive. But the service, I think, recognizes the need to have an affordable mix of both. And I think this is a little bit of rebalancing in that effort.
If I could jump in, I would just add, like, you are seeing, like, the Joint Strike Missile, which is the anti-ship missile that the F-35 can carry, the Naval Strike Missile airborne variant they're continuing to procure. So a lot of more long range, as Hannah indicated, but some of those important short range ones. In terms of replenishing stockpiles, I mean, the biggest impact there is not on the Air Force, but the Army. And having seen Doug Bush recently and talked to him and heard from other Army leaders, their replenishment really depends on the additional appropriations that are in the supplemental. It is a lot of the money that is intended to buy back the different munitions and the different equipment that has been provided to Ukraine, in addition to supplying Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel with other equipment. So it's really important for that to pass. And a lot of the industrial-based improvements are also embedded in there. So things like expanding GMLRS rocket motor production, which is built in the Allegheny Ballistics Laboratory, which Hannah and I visited a few weeks ago, there's a massive expansion underway, which would significantly improve our capacity to produce one of the most critical components of precision-guided weapons that is in limited supply today, the rocket motor. And that might not happen if Congress doesn't pass that bill.
Stacey, you suggested the problem is obviously worse for the Army. But in order to be able to do NASAMS, for example, the air defense system that uses AMRAAM missiles, the United States has been going all of its allies and partners and using up whatever inventories we'd built up, especially of the older weapons, to give the Ukrainians better air and missile defenses. We are using munitions at a vast rate. And there are some who suggest one of the reasons why we're not sending another tranche of aid to the Ukrainians, we're just uncomfortable sending more and leaving ourselves vulnerable, God forbid something happens. Are we moving nearly as fast as we need to move to replenish these stocks? You know, we cover air and missile defenses with Dr. Tom Carrico of CSIS. It's dawning on us that even at our peak, we didn't have enough air and missile defenses. And now the Houthis are helping deplete, you know, the Navy's standard missile rounds that they need for a confrontation with China or Russia or anybody else for that matter. Where are we in restocking ourselves? And what's the reasonable interval before we start doing this? Because at this rate, I mean, what do? Like, use sticks and stones?
I think this is partially, like Stacey was talking about, because of the budget environment that we're in and because of the tough trades that the Air Force is having to make. And it made the tough decision, I think, to focus more on R&D and future capabilities. Munitions is always like the can that gets kicked down the road. So I do think it's important to keeping tabs on it. But I don't think that the message is lost on them that it is something that we'll have to begin focusing on again in the near future. But I think this says a lot more about this year's budget environment, which hopefully is resolved soon.
Yeah, and I just want to add, I agree with Hannah, that I think you're seeing industry respond and normally respond well to systems that have hot production lines right now. It's really the ones that are nearly closed or in cold status, like the Stinger, and there are huge obsolescence problems, where it's been even more difficult. Raytheon's pumped up AMRAAM production significantly. I think they've more than doubled what they had been doing before Ukraine. And one of the wonderful things about the NASAMS defense system is that AMRAAM is so widely used by NATO countries that there are many different nations that can dip into their stockpiles to supply Ukraine. All of that being said, I do agree that we haven't moved fast enough across the board, right? And a lot of this is due to the sort of logjam in Congress, because the companies aren't going to expand production lines unless they have contracts. Those multi-year procurement contracts are huge in terms of helping to invest in expanding production capacity and also giving that stable demand signal that Hannah's work has shown is so important for multiple years, that they're willing to make those investments and those bets. In terms of air defenses, and Tom's definitely the expert here, but you can see that this is a huge cost competition. And this has been going on in Ukraine as well, right? They don't want to use an AMRAAM to shoot down a Shahed, just like we don't want to use an SM-2 or an SM-6 or anything that expensive to shoot down a $50,000 drone. And that we have to find affordable counters. And you have some really innovative things out there with like the Vampire system, using the guided rockets on a truck, and looking at developing modern gun systems that offer a more economical cost per shot. And then there's the prospect of future directed energy, whether it's high-powered microwave or lasers that could be used, but that we need to be finding those cost-effective counters now and having those layers. But we definitely, I think, have underpurchased air defenses, are one of those, unlike a lot of just air-to-air missiles, we haven't engaged in much air-to-air combat, but the ground-to-air, there have been a lot of those defense missiles expended across time.
Stacey, a little earlier on, you were talking about the strategy for integrating uninhabited systems with crewed aircraft. Are you seeing differences among the services in how well they are doing in that? And are those differences reflected in this budget?
It's really hard to see that in the budget, because I think a lot of it has to do with what they're able to talk about. And that varies, I think, across the services. You see the Army doing more and doing more publicly in their experiments with Project Convergence and different types of uncrewed systems of various sizes that they're using as a part of their MDO concept. The Air Force, you know, hasn't talked quite as much about exactly how the CCA aircraft will be operated or integrated with the crewed system, whether it's going to be a quarterback. You know, sometimes you hear people talking about that, like they're controlling it and it's tethered to the human who's controlling several of the drones, or vice versa. And I think a lot of that is still much more in the concept development stage, and also determining how comfortable they are in general. Certainly, the weapons we have aren't fully autonomous, and policy allows the United States to do that as long as there is sufficient human supervision. I forget the exact word in the policy, but we've been on the conservative side of that. So as other countries are probably going to be the ones that are going to be more likely to innovate on the autonomy side or actually deploy it, would be my guess, than the United States. The Russians are pushing and the Chinese are as well.
Let me take you to the nuclear modernization question, which is sort of the crazy elephant with the running chainsaw in the basement, right? Or attic, or however it is. That is a horribly mixed metaphor, but I apologize for that. Sentinel is so over budget right now, the ground-based strategic deterrent, as it is called. The Navy is looking at an increased cost for the Columbia ballistic missile submarine. What has to happen here, Stacey, for the services to basically still be able to modernize at whatever level with programs that are generational, as big as they are? Secretary Kendall is recused from overseeing this program, but has said this is an IT program, it's a real estate program, it's a technology program, it's a rocket program. I mean, it's among the most complicated modernization efforts we've done in a long time. What has to happen here for the nuclear modernization, which is critical to replace the Minuteman? And then the Minuteman is going to have to stay in service, and that's going to cost more money. What's the way out of this sort of coffin corner that we're building ourselves? Because the services aren't necessarily getting more money, even if they're required to do this stuff.
I'm not sure. You've pointed to exactly the biggest tension, I think, within the procurement budget. And that's really nuclear modernization versus conventional modernization. And there's not an easy dividing line for a lot of that, since, you know, the B-21 obviously is a critical capability that the U.S. would employ as a part of conventional operations if it were in a major war, in addition to being a nuclear delivery platform. But I've been doing a lot of research on the U.S.'s and SAC's nuclear history and the development of the early ICBMs. And, you know, we haven't actually fielded an ICBM since, well, fielded in large numbers since the 70s, since the Peacemaker was canceled. And those programs were so complicated. And it's just all of the factors that you're highlighting. We think it's really easy, just replace and put a missile. But the infrastructural requirements and the silos and all of the constructions that's needed is really pretty massive. And when you take into account that these structures need to be hardened to be able to survive at least some level of nuclear blast, that further complicates it. And now we're trying to retrofit the silos that are 50, 60 years old and put in new missiles and a new command and control construct and everything else. That I think there's a lot going on beyond simply replacing the missile that is driving the cost overruns. And I compare it perhaps not favorably to a house renovation, where I live in an older house and, you know, you think you have something simple and they open the wall and then they're like, oh, look at this. And I feel like there's probably a lot of that going on with Sentinel, where they're dealing with such a old base in terms of the silos and then trying to figure out how to modernize that. And that's just a massive undertaking. I do think it's incredibly important. I do think people don't fully appreciate how difficult that is. And it is clearly a strain on the ability of the Air Force in particular to field conventional forces at the same time.
Finally, one of CNAS's signatures is the use of wargaming to illustrate the effects of strategic and budgetary choices. You've run some recent games on various subjects. Can you tell us some of the latest lessons you've learned?
I'll let Hannah jump in a second. I would say we've been continuing to do some work that Hannah and I started on thinking about the implications of China's nuclear buildup, and then sort of thinking through what this means for crisis stability inside of a conflict and whether it increases the likelihood that China might be willing to use nuclear weapons. And we just ran some follow-up games to that that were looking at the potential for nuclear use and how the U.S. could respond to it in a protracted conflict, because we concluded that in the early stages of a conflict, nuclear use wasn't particularly likely beyond coercive threats, because China has a lot of other capabilities that they would try to use first. But when you move farther into a conflict and those conventional weapons, especially the preferred long-range ones, have been expended, you also start seeing the value of nuclear weapons. You know, they can have area effects, but still modern weapons today, fairly discriminate ones if they're smaller yield and precision guided, and they can take out a installation for a longer period of time. So when you're planning on keeping fighting instead of suppressing the airbase for 12 or 24 hours, you know, knocking it out for weeks or months could be a significant difference. So unfortunately, we've been seeing that the likelihood of limited nuclear use, which is low, I think, still to begin with, is, however, going up, and that it might be fairly discrete and not sort of lead to general nuclear war in the way that we thought about it during the Cold War. So I think there are a lot of issues related to the intersection between conventional precision-guided weapons and nuclear weapons that our colleague Andrew Metrick's been looking at that are interesting and worth exploring in both the context of Europe and Asia.
Let me just ask, what's your assessment of Russia, right? China is not threatening nuclear weapon use. They're just doing a nuclear buildup, whereas the Russians are actively threatening our allies and partners, so much so that the White House was panicked in October 2022. David Sanger had some great reporting, and Jim Sciutto's had some great reporting on this as well from CNN, and David's obviously with the New York Times. What's your sense, and how does Russia play into that dynamic?
I mean, Russia is obviously a country that has nuclear capability as central to its armed forces and a lot of its doctrine. So you have to take it seriously when there are threats. Thus far, I do think a lot of it has been bluster. When you look at the broader sort of course of bargaining that's been going on during the Ukraine conflict, you see that both sides have actually been fairly careful in terms of what they're willing to do and pushing what they perceive to be the other's red lines. And those red lines have moved over time. That's one of the other observations that we had from the recent war games, is that red lines can be revised, especially in conflicts that go on for a long time. And I think you've seen this in Ukraine, right? I mean, it's crazy. The Ukrainians have sent long-range kamikaze drones to attack strategic bomber bases. If you said that to me in a war game, like, we would normally automatically assume that the red team, though they get to decide, would see that as crossing a threshold for some sort of retaliatory strike, if not nuclear use. And that hasn't happened. So I think both sides have been very aware and made a concerted effort to keep the conflict constrained to Ukraine and not to bring in NATO or the United States, which is a great thing. And I wouldn't imagine that the pressure for nuclear use, whether it's escalate to de-escalate or whatever, would grow right now, just given that Russian forces are not exactly winning, but they certainly seem to have a slight advantage right now. So any pressure to resort to nuclear use seems to probably have declined, because they've increased their production of conventional weapons and, you know, are advantaged against the Ukrainians, who aren't getting the support that they need from the United States and Europe.
It's a big budget with lots of details. Dr. Stacey Pettyjohn, Hannah Dennis from the Center for a New American Security, thanks so much for helping us shine light in all those corners.
It was great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Air Power Podcast. And if you liked what you heard, hey, tell a friend, unless you think it would give them a competitive advantage. Thanks also to GE Aerospace for powering the entire flight. We'll be back next week.